drones and the snipers take aim at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Hunger Games. People walk for 10 or 20 miles to find soldiers everywhere when they arrive, who give them 20 minutes to fight for food, and then with ammunition live, the snipers, drones, and tanks mow them down, morning after morning, just the same, at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Hunger Games. Everybody knows they're risking death, measuring their lives by the hour, but especially if they walk in the open where they need to go to try to get some flour. Most come back empty-handed with stories of those killed and maimed at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Hunger Games. Was the cradle of civilization and the place where that all ended, where humans found new ways to show inhumanity that could never be defended. Israelis and Americans, to their eternal shame, who ran the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Hunger Games. As the Gaza district becomes one big apocalypse.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, if you can make sense of what's happening between Israel and Iran, you're a better geopolitical analyst than me. If you can't, well, then you're in luck, because I've got just such a person on the line. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest level, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and the recently released Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. John's recent article at Dances with Bears. Congratulations to everyone in Ropadope strategy. The bell also sounds for rest periods. Bravely sallies forth into the breach of both Western media narratives and Donald Trump's cognitive and dictive capabilities. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure. John, I think America's president summed up what we've all suspected yesterday in saying what he said about the leadership of Iran and Israel vis-a-vis their reaction to his unilaterally declared ceasefire. Your article, John, provides some historical context of what the Trump brokered deal said before he said those naughty words. John, did Trump's ceasefire conditions guarantee a failure from the outset with this?
Well, just to take it at its most limited, Chris, Trump gave an announcement of, I think, 6 hours. I got to stick the papers in front of me. He, in his first tweet announcing it, and bearing in mind he was making grandstanding in making the announcement that he was the ruler of the world, the president of the world, the pope of the world, a point that he made again in the last few hours at his NATO press conference. He said that in approximately 6 hours from now, when Israel and Iran have wound down and completed their final missions for 12 hours, at which point the war will be considered ended. So there's a gap and an ambiguity in what he said between 6 and 12 hours when he was ringing the bell on the rest period between the fighting. Then what he did was to lose his temper. You heard him say that on the way to the NATO, he used for the first time the F expletive to show that he was angry. He was angry because of a sequence of tweets he'd recorded, in which he recorded his anger, that a couple of hours after his, 7 hours after his first tweet, the announcement tweet, said the ceasefire is now in effect, please do not violate it. The Israelis must have then told him they were following his order, because after 30 minutes, he tweeted, Israel is not going to attack Iran. All planes will turn around and head home while doing a friendly plane wave to Iran. Nobody will be hurt. The ceasefire is in effect. But 6 hours further on, he tweeted, Israel, and these are caps, Israel, do not drop those bombs. If you do, it's a major violation. Bring your pilots home now. And he then supported a regime change in Iran in a tweet. And then after a few more hours, he tweeted his big thanks to Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So what I think had happened, what he's hinting at happened, is that the length of time he allowed for his ceasefire to take place was used by the Israelis to make several attacks. After those landed, including a radar site and a couple of other, I've seen 4 or 5 targets. The Iranians responded. Trump sent Huckabee to speak to the Israelis. There was apparently a call between Huckabee, Trump, and Netanyahu, and the Israeli so-called retaliation or ceasefire violation was stopped. And so after several hours, the ceasefire Trump had announced prematurely, and you know his tweets represent Trump's form of premature ejaculation, the ceasefire has been implemented. But that's talking tactically. Strategically, what has to happen next, and the reason there is a ceasefire agreed by both sides, the U.S. is beginning to resupply Israel. Trump has just announced at NATO that he'll be supplying Patriot missile systems to Israel to replenish those that have been already defeated. And he's considering sending more Patriots to the Ukraine, which has been requesting them for a longer time. And on the Ukrainian battlefield, as we've often said, Russia has shown the capability to defeat whatever he sends. So tactically, yes, there's a rest period between rounds. Let's talk some more about what that means.
Well, so this rift then between Trump and Israel and Netanyahu is, it looks like theater to me, is the ceasefire too seems like theater. The retaliation by Iran against America for its bombing of the nuclear sites in Iran, that seems like theater too. It was a telegraphed punch, to stay with your rope-a-dope analysis, or analogy rather,
yes,
as was the original bombing by the American side in Iran, telegraphed and giving everybody time to put everything safely away and in order. So is there anything real about this Iran-Israel war and America-Israel war and maybe even the whole Russia-Ukraine war? Maybe that's all pretend as well.
I don't think it's pretend at all. Iran has taken a very considerable beating by Israel, supported by the United States. But to go back to your first point, yes, all of those podcasters and pundits who were trying, hopefully, to preserve Trump's reputation in their minds and other parts of their body as a peacemaker, all of those pundits were confounded. We didn't ever think Trump and Netanyahu had fallen out. The suggestion that they might was either an intentional deception as part of a long-term Israel attack plan, or it was simply a theater, as you said. The situation basically is, as Trump explained it in the press conference a couple of hours ago, he thinks he has produced the ceasefire ending this last round of India-Pakistan warfare. He said he had ended the war between Congo and Rwanda. He said he had ended or was resolving the Kosovo conflict. He said he's thinking of how to resolve the Ukraine war. He thinks he not only is in contention for the Nobel Peace Prize, but that he is in fact the president of the world. And what he's shown strategically in the Israel-Iran war is that his force decides everything. On the one hand, his backing for Israel's long-developed plan to attack Iran, decapitate its leadership, and start the process of partitioning of Iran into a smaller, weaker ethnic states, Kurdish state, Azeri state, Arab state, a Baluchistan or a Baluchi state, and a mini Persia. That's remains, that regime change plus partition remains in Trump's head. He's clearly indicated, for example, in his press gaggle on the way to the Netherlands a day before, that he still thinks regime change in Iran might be a good thing. But in the meantime, he's concerned to prevent chaos. Well, basically, the strategic objective in which Trump supported Israel all the way has failed. The Israelis did achieve decapitation of military leadership, but Iran recovered. The rally round the flag phenomenon in Iran also suggests that the partition plan has for the time being failed, but it hasn't been shelved.
When Iran bombed Israel, it seems the effects that the Israelis were hoping to have in Iran, with people turning on their leadership and losing faith in the government and the country starting to fall to pieces, actually was visited on Israel itself. We've seen videos of riotous behavior in bomb shelters, some Israelis being less Israeli than others, not being allowed in if their skin was slightly off hue, or if they didn't have the right inflection in their accents, not being allowed access into the bomb shelters at all, let alone all the foreign workers that were left out in the cold to brave the missiles alone.
These are very good points, Chris. And I simply want to emphasize for our audience, these are very valuable points you're making, and they're not made at all in the mass media or even in the podcast media, in the alt media. They, like you and I, understand that Israel is a white supremacist, racist, imperial creation. And Trump is one of those white supremacist, racist creators and will always endorse and support Israel. So what's going to happen next is he's going to repair all the damage that Israel has suffered, and it suffered very considerable damage. As you said, it showed the strains of being under attack at a level it has never suffered before. Yes, compared to Israel's earlier wars going back to the 1930s, Israel has probably suffered fewer casualties, people killed. But on the other hand, for the first time, Israel has demonstrated its vulnerability to having its lights turned off, to having its ports shut down, to having its energy infrastructure, coal, gas, oil, and electricity damaged beyond repair or damaged for lengthy periods of time, which destroys its economy. This vulnerability, Israel demonstrated an inability with U.S. equipment to repel hypersonic missiles from Iran. So this is a strategic defeat for Israel. It's not a strategic defeat for Iran. Iran has been able to bear the damage and will now repair the damage. Israel will repair the damage, but faces a long-term loss of confidence. And that's where its superiority complex has been significantly shaken.
Well, and the press too, John, has de-emphasized the exodus from Israel, even though the authorities there shut down the airports and wouldn't allow people to leave, or at least Israeli citizens to leave of a certain stripe. We saw this great Dunkirkian exodus, although sort of Dunkirk in reverse, with Israelis fleeing to Cyprus and Greece, leaping down the rat lines as fast as their little legs would carry them.
Again, a very valuable point that isn't properly being made, Chris. I mean, basically, this is Israeli propaganda, American propaganda, creating daisy chains in the almost pornographic sense of media pundits reinforcing each other in repeating a narrative that's false. And this is what's happening. And what you point out is the number of weaknesses that this war has demonstrated in Israel, which are being covered up, both the physical damage and the human damage and the vulnerability of this small state. So strategically, Israel's in serious trouble for the long term. And that's why we've called the Iranian strategy, or the Iranian, Chinese, Russian, North Korean strategy, a rope-a-dope, a long-term capability to endure punishment, to be ended later on when the opponent is exhausted and vulnerable to knockout. That's the strategy as best one can make it. And Iran has survived its first punishments. Israel also, but Israel looks weaker, only nobody's allowed to say it. So guerrilla radio says it. Well, and many of the other podcasters do not.
Well, I think daisy chain in the Canadian nomenclature is more familiar as a circle jerk. The Iranians were pretty livid, it seemed, at least, with Russia and China and the support or lack thereof that they were getting. You quoted them, and I can't remember the entire quote, but it was something to the effect, and please correct me, that we may forget what our enemies, the slurs our enemies throw at us, but we'll never forget the silence of our friends. How serious is the rift, if there is one, between Iran and China and Russia, who in a lot of those same podcasts you mentioned, they take it for granted that China and Russia is always supporting Iran and will do all they ask, etc.?
That's a very long question I need to answer. A long answer I need to answer for your question. In the first place, I have to clarify, and this has happened only in the last few hours, I quoted that particular criticism of Russia and China, which was accompanied by a picture of President Putin with President Xi Jinping, came from something called, a Telegram account called Sepahi News. Sepahi it means a guard, and it has a long history as a cavalry, a reference to a light cavalry in Iranian, Persian, and European history. That appears to have been faked. It is shown that Sepahi News is shown in Wiki, for example, to be a media outlet of the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. But I've subsequently come to believe it may be fake. On the other hand, and so one has to take a fake with a very large measure of skepticism and understand it's intended to show a criticism between the IRGC leadership, Russia and China. That's the fake part, the exaggeration part. The real part isn't very different. The real part is that, as we've talked on this program before, Chris, there's hundreds of years of mistrust, suspicion, and fighting between Russia and Persia. I've called that in previous programs and pieces I've done the difference between the Griboyedov line, a 19th century Russian diplomat who was in favor of negotiating with the Persians and lost his life in an attack on the Russian embassy in Persia. And the Yermolov line, a general who in the Russian army believed that the only way to deal with the Iranians was force. Now, the combination and the contrast between Griboyedov line and Yermolov line in Russian thinking has changed very dramatically in the 20th century. And the attempts that Russia has made to negotiate with first the Shah of Iran, then the Khomeini regime in 79, and now the current Iranian leadership, have been bedeviled by distrust and unwillingness to accept each other's offers of negotiation, unwillingness to allow Russia to assist, or on the Russian side, the Iranians to be believed. Now, we can go back very quickly because we don't have much time today to point out that in the coverage, there has been a strategic pact signed in January 2025 by President Putin and the Iranian President Pezeshkian that clearly has, in Article 4, a commitment on the Russian side to provide cooperation, military cooperation, intelligence sharing cooperation with the Iranians. President Putin has twice said publicly, last week in St. Petersburg, that there are no military cooperation, there's no military assistance obligation on the part of Russia under that pact. That's wrong. He repeated it because there were there was a considerable backlash at his remarks. First point. Second, President Putin has tried to balance in the conflict between Israel and Iran. And we've talked about that problem, a very serious problem quietly discussed in Russia in previous programs. What we have now is a very clear effort on the part of both the Iranian side, presented at the Kremlin by Foreign Minister Araghchi earlier this week on Monday, and President Putin and the military consensus. When President Putin met with Araghchi on Monday, he was accompanied for the very first time by Admiral Igor Kostyakov, who heads the GRU, the military intelligence agency attached to the general staff. That's a signal that Russia is prepared to meet its obligations under the Article 4 of the treaty when and if Iran makes up its mind to ask for a new level of assistance. And that new level of assistance is going to come and it's going to be secret. In the meantime, not to downplay it, both Russian officials and Chinese officials have said publicly they condemn the attacks on Iranian sovereignty. Clearly, both China and Russia do not want to see partition of Iran. Now, partition of Iran was sought by Stalin during World War II and in the aftermath of World War II, because of Stalin's very considerable concern that Iran would become a platform for Anglo-American threats to Russia on the Southern Front.
Which, of course, it did do in the subsequent. Yes. Sorry to stand in, but we are, as you mentioned, running short of time. But for those who've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with John Helmer. John Helmer's a journalist and author. He spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind Dances with Bears. We are discussing his recent article at Dances. Congratulations to everyone in Rope-a-Dope strategy. The bell also sounds for rest periods. At that talk that Putin gave at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum a few days ago, he made some really interesting points, John, and you've written about them too. But I'll just say the ones that that pricked my ears. He went on about not wanting to antagonize Israel or something, I'm paraphrasing, because there's so many Russian-speaking Israelis. In fact, it could almost be considered a Russian-speaking country, that most of these are oligarchs and their families. I don't know, he didn't mention Also, he said that the Iranians didn't want to take any help from them. You said that they're still under Article 4 waiting for when the Iranians say that they will. I find that impossible to believe that they would be refusing military aid or supplies. And then he mentioned that Russia was giving refuge to high-ranking Iranians, not specifying, but hinting that maybe it was even the Ayatollah had run away to Russia to seek shelter, he and his family or something. All three of these comments seem to undermine Iran. Do you agree?
I have to clarify that and qualify. It was a source of mine in Moscow who identified the readiness of Russia to provide a security refuge for a number of leadership families. That didn't come from President Putin. What came from President Putin was the two main things that you mentioned. First, that Israel has a very large number of Russian speakers, and that was one of his reasons for trying to balance. Well, it's an argument he's made before, and as you've just pointed out, Israel is a refuge for the Russian opposition, Russian-speaking opposition, including Mikhail Khodorkovsky's partner, Leonid Nevzlin, and many others, opposition to Putin. It's strange to see the president of Russia having an uber-Semitic, a sentimental attachment either to those people, which he clearly does not, or to Russian speakers who have demonstrated turning their back on Russia when they emigrated to Israel. Israel is a nationality, a passport, and a religion that a number of Russians used to exit their own country. It's a sign of disloyalty, which is the standard, the consensus Russian view about Russians who move to Israel. It's disloyalty, not loyalty. Now, when Russian speakers first demonstrated their loyalty to Russia in the Donbass in 2014, President Putin did not show anything like the level of support and sympathy, which he's now showing to Russian speakers in Israel.
Well, I don't understand how he can expect, Putin can expect to remain being taken seriously when he's acting like this. I certainly can't take him seriously. John, as you said, we're a little truncated today, and I'm sorry for that. Thanks a lot for coming on, and I want to urge everyone to go to John's site, johnhelmer.net. Dances with Bears. You'll find links to his many erudite articles, and you will get, as he said, of this show, you'll get stuff that you'll get an understanding of the issues that you just don't get listening to the crap that we have on this side of the Atlantic, for sure.
Thank you for having me, Chris, but I do need to point out that President Putin learns lessons and changes his mind, so that the next time we come to talk, you will find a significantly improved and a position in the military and political and Kremlin consensus towards Russian assistance in the future.
Well, let's hope his trial and error system of learning can outlast the imminent dangers posed to he and the country. I want to thank also Dorotea Guchardo for coming on, and remind everyone to go to glia.org to see what about their work that they're doing in Gaza. That's glia.org. Thanks again, John.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chris.
Most come back empty-handed with stories of those killed and maimed at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation Hunger Games. It was the cradle of civilization and the place where that all ended, where humans found new ways to show inhumanity that could never be defended. Israelis and Americans, to their eternal shame, who ran the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Hunger Games as the Gaza district becomes one big apocalypse.